Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and cultural program of African Sisters Media Network. We are joined in the studio by Bonnie Boswell. She's executive producer of this wonderful new film, The Power Broker, Whitney Young's Fight for Civil Rights. And this film is going to be having a national debut on ITVS on February 18th. Good morning.
Good morning.
The film about your uncle is just simply fantastic. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you, and then you could tell us about your Uncle Whitney and this great film that you produced. Ms. Boswell is an award-winning reporter, producer, commentator, and talk show host. She is Chief Executive Officer of Blue Gate Media, Program Director of the Whitney Young Film and Leadership Program, and the executive producer of this film that we're going to be talking about this morning, The Power Broker, Whitney Young's Fight for Civil Rights. Ms. Boswell's articles have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Essence Magazine, and the Radcliffe Quarterly. She has been a guest on NBC's Today Show, CNN's Talk Back, the CBS Radio Network, and at Harvard University, Princeton University, and the University of Southern California. She is also a past executive board member of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and she was just here on Martin King Day for a special Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area screening of the film. How did that go?
It was great. It was really wonderful. I had never been to MOAG before, and it was fun being in that space, especially on the day of inauguration and Martin Luther King's birthday. So that was fun, and we had some veterans of the civil rights movement who were on the panel and were able to share some of their experiences. And I always love, after the screening, to talk with the audience and really get their impression. So that's always one of the big payoffs for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about the making of this film and your uncle. You said that, you knew him as a member of the family, as Uncle Whitney. But you didn't know sort of the breadth of the work that he did, for sort of ensuring, the civil rights, particularly economic development, for the Black community here in America.
Well, yeah, I was, a young girl when March on Washington was going on. And that was the first time I saw him as more than just an uncle. Before then, he was this really nice, wonderful guy at our family gatherings, and I really had a warmness in my heart for him always, but I didn't really understand his national prominence and role until I saw him on television when I was with my grandparents in Kentucky, which is where I spent a lot of time myself as a kid with his parents. And the excitement around the house, seeing him on television, I was like, wow, what's Uncle Whitney doing on television? So that was my first impression. So I didn't really grasp, the significance of his work at all at that time. And of course, I was busy being, a kid and doing my school, so I didn't really understand, all the things he was involved in. But, as I began to enter into an integrated world myself, because I had been in basically a segregated environment for a lot of years myself, but then as I started going to an integrated school, University of Chicago Laboratory School and High Park in Chicago, then, I was going through a lot of my own adjustments, and so I began to really personally, go through an encounter with racism in a different kind of way. So I think, what he was doing began to take on new meaning for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was born July 31st, 1921, so he was a contemporary of Malcolm X and Martin King, and then he passed, March 11, 1971, so he didn't live that long.
Right, he was 49 years old, very young man.
Yeah, really young. Mm-hmm. Right, but he did so much. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was really, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to make this film, was because I wanted to lift up his accomplishments, certainly, which were many, but also the role he played, too. It's kind of the ideas that he represents even today, I think, are really important for us to think about. I got the idea for doing this film when I was asked to speak on behalf of my mother, who passed away in 2002. And so I began to reflect on Uncle Whitney's capacity to build bridges between ethnic groups and economic groups. And I thought, well, this is the kind of leadership we really need to role model in America and in the world, really, because, you know, we are a diverse society, and so whoever has the capacity to, you know, create consensus is somebody we really need to learn from. So that was my intention in doing the film.
Yeah, I was just looking looking at sort of, you know, sort of the legacy that he was born into. You know, his mother, Laura Young, was the first female postmistress in Kentucky, the first African-American postmistress in Kentucky, and then the second in the United States. And then his father was president of Lincoln Institute, which was where your uncle was raised and educated. And then he, you know, he was so well educated. You know, he got his bachelor's of science degree from Kentucky State University, a historically black institution. And there he was a member of the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. And then during World War II, he trained as an electrical engineer at MIT. You know, his relationship with his wife was really, really wonderful. You know, he met her at the University of Minnesota, where he earned his master's degree in social work. And I just think, wow, that's so interesting, you know, the kind of work he did was so in line with his work, his training, you know.
I agree. Yeah, he and Margaret actually met at Kentucky State, but he did go to the University of Minnesota and got his social work degree. And, you know, I think as I learned by doing the film, the skill sets that he learned as a professional really helped him make the kind of contribution that he made. So, for example, I mean, I had an opportunity to be with Dorothy Height about him and, you know, was talking with her about Whitney Young's role as a mediator even within the inner circle of the civil rights leaders. So, you know, people, a lot of times there'd be tension between the leaders. And so within the inner circle, Whitney played a consensus-building role. And so I asked her about that, what her opinion was. And I had the assumption that because he had this really beautiful, you know, charismatic personality, that was, you know, that was why he was able to do what he did. But she looked at me with great intensity and, you know, direction and said, talking about herself and him, she said, "We were social workers." And, you know, a light went off in my head when I heard that because, you know, I realized that this is a skill set that social workers have. You know, their mission in a given situation is to bring people together and keep them together. And so that to me was really enlightening on many levels because I realized that this is not, you know, something that is just about personality, but these are skill sets that can be taught to others. So I think that's a really hopeful kind of message that, you know, we can teach young people to become consensus builders, to be mediators. And I think that's exactly what we need moving forward.
And what I really liked about your film is how you have all these folks, you know, talking about, you know, your uncle that are no longer with us, like Dr. Height, Dorothy Height, and Howard Zinn, and Ossie Davis. It's like, oh my goodness, you've got Donna Rumsfeld, Julian Bond, Vernon Jordan, John Lewis, Kenneth Chenault. I mean, it's like, wow. Talk about how you sort of pulled all these voices together and talk about, you know, sort of the team. You know, this is like a family affair, right? I mean, your son is worked on the film.
Yeah, exactly. Well, first question, I mean, you know, in terms of, you know, the breadth of interviews we have, I think that kind of shows the good and the bad news about independent filmmaking is that it takes a long time to do, much longer than one would think. And so because the scope of time was so long in terms of, you know, raising the funds to be able to do it and all that, which was the difficult part of it. The good part of it was that we were able to capture people early on who are no longer with us. And even though I had no money to start off with, I had basically like a family camera and, you know, new friends who had cameras, and I would go into a sitting and say, you know, I remember seeing Dorothy Height at one point, and she was like about 90, and I saw her at an Urban League convention giving, interestingly, a Whitney Young Award. And, you know, I could tell, you know, she was up in years, and I thought, oh, my gosh, I got to get her, like, next week, you know. And so, you know, I did. I mean, I just would grab these various interviews, all kinds of quality film, I mean, just the whole bit. But at the end of the day, it becomes very, very rich, and I'm so incredibly grateful to have had these interviews. And yes, it has been a family affair. I mean, my son was one of the directors and producers of this film. It was really amazing having him work on this project with me. Neither one of us intended to work on it together. That was not my intention or his intention. He wants to do feature films, and I thought, working with your son is a whole other zone. So I thought, we'll just kind of do our own thing. But, we were both at a point where it made sense for us to work together, and he brought an incredible amount of vision and energy and perspective, a youthful perspective, and all that to it, and his artistic sensibilities are so great, and he was able to help us to hire another director who's wonderful, Christine Kalafian, and she's amazing. So, and then my husband is a lawyer, and so we were able to get a lot of in-kind help from him, as well as research help. And then I have a younger son who was at Columbia at the time when we were making a film, and the Whitney Young Papers are housed at Columbia, so I was like, Evan, can you run up there and get this, piece of document? So, definitely all hands on deck kind of thing. I don't know how you can do without a family.
Wow, it's so amazing. And, he was, in the 1960s, he was the executive director of the National Urban League, and one of the few African Americans who had the ears of those who controlled the levers of power. I'm reading from the synopsis. Fortune 500 CEOs, governors, senators, and presidents. And could you talk about how we use these relationships to gain better access to employment, education, housing, and health care for African Americans, and about his idea for the Marshall Plan for our community? Yet the work he was doing, because he was a lot of times the only black man in these circles, was not seen in a positive light often. I mean, he was so misunderstood. It reminds me of the relationship between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, right. And also Marcus Garvey, how the press and the dominant discourse was that they couldn't all be working for the good of our community, yet they all were.
Right. Right. Now, I think one of the great things is that, Uncle Whitney understood, and I think, eventually, a lot of people who were around at that time understood that everybody's playing a different and important role. Where he at one point had conversations with Malcolm X when they both acknowledged that each of them were important roles. And, I think that the maturity is to understand that you don't have to have, nor should you have, just one voice at the table. You need people who are going to be, being more vocal, and yet you also need people who are going to, say, okay, how are we going to get this done? I think that one of the things that, is really important is understand that this sensibility that Whitney had as a social worker was able to be translated into his work as a civil rights leader, because, it wasn't enough just to have the voting laws changed and the laws changed to say that, you could live in any place you wanted to live. Of course, that was incredibly important. At the same time, he understood that if you didn't have a good education, you couldn't get a good job, you wouldn't get good money, and therefore you couldn't afford to live in the neighborhood you wanted to live in. So, he was about the business of trying to get the infrastructure in place so that people could live and, carry out a full life wherever they wanted to. And that's, the basics of, economics. So, this is what he was pushing for as a social worker. He really wanted people, and also the mission of the National Urban League was to help people to get those jobs and so on and so forth. So that was his training, his understanding, and his mission. And so he worked, behind the scenes and had conversations with people who had that kind of power, who could influence a company. A Fortune 500 a CEO could influence his own company to say, we need to have this company become more diverse. And Uncle Whitney always talked about the fact that, this is good for business, first of all. It's a pragmatic approach. It's not just a good thing to do morally, although that is important, but you need to have, an educated workforce. You need to have people who are diverse in your own office. So I think he was able to appeal to people on not only the moral grounds, but on the pragmatic grounds as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about some of the, I guess, some of the key landmark kind of things that happen with, you know, sort of that, because of the type of work that that Whitney Young was doing. Could you talk about some of the key, like, for instance, he was, you mentioned, well, it's mentioned that, you know, there were some key events in the Civil Rights era, you know, besides the March on Washington in 1963 and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that he was directly sort of involved in their implementation. I suppose you could talk about some of these key landmark legislative successes or economic successes that, that he was responsible for. I think it's really funny. I think it's Henry Louis Gates Jr. that talked about how he really liked your uncle's voice. He just thought he was just so, just like, so impeccable in his presentation as a person, you know?
Right, exactly. One of my favorite stories, it's not in the film, but it's a great story, I think, that illustrates his capacity to, you know, open up doors and talk about, you know, significant things. I mean, one of the things, just to back up a little bit, obviously, was his domestic Marshall Plan, which is this concept he had about how to really infuse funds and attention into the inner city in order to bring about the kind of systemic change that he thought was going to be important in terms of, you know, leveraging this idea of power to get more money into the community so that you can have better schools and housing and so on and so forth. So he understood that America had never done this as far as African Americans were concerned at large, and there had never really been a redress of the of slavery and of segregation. And so since there had been no prior program to really address this, what he did understand was that America knew about the Marshall Plan, which had been an effort that the United States had made to help to rebuild Western Europe after the war. So there was that, you know, image that everybody had been comfortable with. And what he said was, okay, we bought into this concept of helping to rebuild Western Europe. We should also have the same idea of receptivity to rebuilding the, you know, urban cities. You know, it's the same, and we showed pictures, you know, in the film showing, you know, Germany, war-torn Germany, and, you know, and Harlem, you know, so that you could see that there was, they looked almost the same, you know, war-torn kind of places. So I think that was very smart on his part to be able to call it a domestic Marshall Plan, because the concept of the Marshall Plan had already, you know, gained traction, but the idea of it being domestic was the focus. So because of that, he was able to influence Lyndon Johnson later, who was coming into his own in terms of thinking about these issues for the domestic Marshall Plan, I mean, with the, sorry, the War on Poverty, the Great Society. And so a lot of programs that we now take for granted really came out of the thinking that Uncle Whitney was able to influence in terms of that. So, you know, Medicaid, which we talk a lot about right now in the country, but people like was a part of that. Head Start was a part of that, you know, early education, Job Corps, you know, all these kinds of programs that have become a part of American fabric. And as Manny Marable says in the film, you know, where would we be without those programs? So I think that kind of influence is really important. The point I was going to make earlier in terms of influencing corporations to become integrated, to really diversify, one of the things my son, Taylor, was asking us to do is to show what life looked like in the 1950s in corporate America, because he, having been born much later, didn't have a sense of what that looked like. But, you know, we kind of got the Mad Men idea, you know, and put it on film so we could, you know, really help people see it was all white, all male, pretty much all the time, you know, mm-hmm. in these big corporations. And so, you know, we showed what that looked like. And so Whitney Young was introducing this concept, which was not, was unimaginable to a lot of these corporations to have African Americans there. So he went on a trip to Europe, Eastern Europe, with members of Fortune 500 companies. And, you know, this is the first time, again, many of these men who were, you know, the power elite, had really been able to have dialogue or relationship or, you know, long-term, you know, days with, to see an African-American man as a peer, you know, before he'd always been maybe, you know, an athlete or an entertainer or some other entity, but, you know, to really deal with him as a peer. And he was in every way. And so one of his, and he was very affable and so on and so forth. So it, apparently at the end of the trip, one of these gentlemen says to Whitney Young, he taps him on the back and said, gee, Whitney, if more Negroes were like you, we wouldn't have any problems. And he said, yes, and if more white people were like me, we wouldn't have any problems. So I love that. Isn't that great? You know, because, you know, it was a point well made. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the truth. But it was, he said it was funny, you know, people would laugh and they go, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right, mm-hmm. You know. So as a result of that trip and his relationship with those CEOs, many went back to their companies and began to really say, okay, we need to have more people of color, you know, in this, JCPenney or IBM or, you know, the whole group of companies, the Ford Motor Company, that responded to him in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just wondering, you know, you mentioned the term imagination, and I just think about how, you know, when your uncle was, you know, sort of moving in these different circles, you know, for the greater good, you know, as a veteran, you know, serving in a segregated union in the Army during World War II, to mediating tensions between the white and African American service members, you know, to his work, you know, in the civil rights movement when he returned from the war, just thinking about sort of what, you know, sort of what did his, you know, what kind of examples did he get from his parents to be able to like step out there like that? Because he was the only one, and you know, that was probably, I mean, not necessarily scary, but, you know, he was isolated, I mean, and yet he was able to hold his own and be really consistent in his message and be really, you know, he just, you know, sort of really held himself to a really high standard. A lot of times, you know, when he was moving in these circles and he was the only one at a lot of points, and then sometimes the folks that were his allies didn't get it. So then he was really alone. And then finally they did get it. Just wondering, you know, from people that you talk to, did he talk to them about sort of the stresses of that? And then yourself, I mean, you've accomplished a whole lot. And I wondered sort of intergenerationally, sort of that legacy, because he was born at a time when the connection between one's our enslaved ancestors and, you know, freedom, it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't hundreds of years. I mean, you could know people that had experienced enslavement.
Exactly. Well, I think that's a very, very astute question. And actually, the answer to that is one of the reasons I wanted to do the film also, because I was amazed at, you know, his capacity to, as you said, hold his own at the time. But I also felt that I understood a little bit about where that came from, because I was raised by my grandparents when I was very young. You know, my first early years were with my grandparents, and I kind of got firsthand some of those messages. And it wasn't just me. My grandparents, you know, were the heads of a high school, so they gave these lessons not only to their own family, but to, you know, the many, many 400 African-American students who came through there every year. So their job, my grandparents' job in many ways, was to prepare everybody to be able to move from segregation to integration. And so they wanted to empower those young people, all of us, to have the skill sets, the mindfulness to understand what we were encountering and to not let our emotions get away from us. And I think Uncle Whitney, particularly, again, growing up directly in segregation, mine was a little bit more benign. I don't know if I could have served in a segregated army company. I think that would have really made me crazy. But at any rate, that was the time, and a lot of, you know, many men did that. But one of the things my grandfather said, which I think is a good story, and it was following a basketball game Duncan Whitney had attended for school, and you know, their team had been victorious. They went to a diner. He and the teammates went to a diner, a local diner, and were refused entrance. They were asked to eat in the back, and Uncle Whitney apparently was furious about this. Went home and told his father about this great injustice. And my grandfather said, "Well, first of all, Whitney, never let anybody drag you so low as to hate them."
Mm. Wow.
And you know, he also said, "Don't get mad, get smart." You know,
mm-hmm.
So it wasn't about letting your emotions run away with you, but the idea of character was extraordinarily important in our family and in the lessons that both of my grandparents tried to impart to young people, because that's basically at that point in time that was all you had. I mean, you might have had education, but still, you were, if you were an African American, male or female, but particularly male, your life was in jeopardy. You know, if you stepped outside the boundaries of your community, you know, you could be lynched for not much, you know, on your part. So, and nobody had any real money, I mean, to speak of. It wasn't, you know, in life, mom always talked about the A's and B's, seven different kinds of ways, 7 days a week, you know. But they did have education. They were education-oriented. And also, again, this whole aspect of character was very, very important. So it was something with my grandmother, carried herself with, you know, great. You would have thought she was, you know, was the Queen of England or something. I mean, it was just kind of her. She was majestic, basically. You know, she just had this quality about it. And not only that, but she made sure that all of us coming through that school, including, you know, her three children, knew how to talk to people, knew how to engage people. So, you know, she would say to me, I remember, she'd say, you know, go up to Mrs. Brown, say hello, Mrs. Brown, look them in the eye, shake their hand. And she used to do that with Uncle Whitney, too. I know my aunt mentioned that. She would do it with everybody, you know, taught people how to behave. So, you know, so they won respect. And I think it was an important lesson moving forward, again, that we don't let other people influence our behavior so that we drag ourselves down, so that you know, that our character is diminished, because the character is ultimately what you have.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah. So were you speaking about your grandmother, Laura?
Yes, I was. Yeah, Laura.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She
yeah.
is very much the, you know, the mother of the campus. And, you know, I mean, the kids were like, you know, when it was yes, Mrs. Young and no, Mrs. Young. I mean, they learned all of that. And to have pride in themselves. So, but also to be a part of community. And that's the other thing I think is important. I mean, my grandparents really stressed the involvement in the care and protection of everybody on the campus. And so if somebody was sick, you know, then, you know, our family would take them food. Or I remember Aunt Eleanor, my aunt, saying that when kids would come to campus and they didn't have any clothes, my grandmother would go into their closets, her kids' closets, and pull out clothes for them. And, you know, when I was a little girl, I was like 6 years old, and I was spending a lot of time running around this beautiful campus. But before I could go out and play, she made sure that I went over to see how the senior citizen was doing. The nurse at the school, she lived there. You know, I would take my friends over to spend time with her, and I would go over to the custodians and take my friends over there, and went to the, you know, we had these rounds that we had to do every day just to make sure everybody was okay. And that became a part of my DNA, is thinking about, you know, the community, protecting and offering, you know, whatever I could to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's wonderful. So where did you get your training? Where did you go to school?
Well, I started at Tufts University, and then I transferred to Harvard University, mm-hmm. and finished there, and then I went to MIT for my master's degree. So
wow.
That was the academics. That was the academic side of stuff. Yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. So, because your uncle went to MIT too, right?
Yeah, he did. Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So,
yeah.
Did you like run into any of his legacy at MIT?
Not so much of the time. Also, when I was in school, I was kind of, in many ways, more out of school than in school. I mean, when I was at Harvard, I spent 3 days a week working at a daycare center in Roxbury.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my relationship with school was very, you know, it was like in school four hours a week, and then out of school in the community the rest of the time. So, and same thing, when I was at MIT, I spent, you know, a lot of time being other places, doing other things. So I really wanted to be out, you know, involved. And so being at school at that time was kind of challenging for me. I mean, I continued and I finished, but it was, you know, it was not, I wanted to be more where the action was. And, you know, being able to give and be part of the community is what I was really interested in. That's what I did.
So is your training in journalism?
No, not at all. I have no degree in journalism.
Social work?
At all, not even social work. No, because, you know, I was also a little rebellious, I have to say. So I was going to be the not social worker in the family, you know. But journalism has been my tool to really, you know, deal with some of the same issues. So my BA is in anthropology, which is a wonderful topic, because it means you can do anything, and it falls within that subject. And then my master's is in city planning. Which, again, you know, talking about urban issues and so on and so forth. So, I mean, definitely I had that, you know, interest. But I really felt, for me, journalism was a path to being able to express that. And all the work I've done in journalism has been kind of my own way of approaching it. Mm-hmm. So I used to do editorials for WNBC in New York, which was great. And then I had produced a show in New York called Positively Black, and I went to 2020 and was an associate producer there. And then when I got to Los Angeles, I stopped working with my, you know, I had children and stopped working as a full-time parent. And then I did a national talk show with Pastor James Lawson, who is an awesome civil rights leader. And then I, before I started working on this film, I was a reporter, a community reporter for NBC Los Angeles. And so I did a lot of these same kind of stories about, you know, the unsung heroes, people in the community, various communities, and that was a wonderful opportunity as well.
Yeah, sounds like that particular, you know, the unsung heroes, that seems that was just preparation for this major work here, The Power Broker with Life for Civil Rights.
Exactly. I wasn't, you know, hadn't even thought of in those terms at that time, but absolutely, that, you know, he was a big unsung hero sitting right there in the living room, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it became appropriate for me to think about lifting up his ideas at this time, because, you know, it does frustrate me that we still deal with some of the same issues of war and poverty and, you know, the disparity between people. And I know, like everybody knows, that we can do better. We can do better as a society. And we have to find ways to encourage ourselves and to give us examples of how to approach things. And I think Whitney Young's story does that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, you're right that Whitney Young saw that the resolution-focused approach of social work was the key to truly creating society where minorities would have power and status equal to that of white Americans. And this would require that African Americans have, or minorities have, access to the same pillars of the American dream: jobs, health care, education, and housing. And you're right, it's like, that's still the issue.
Still the issue. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we have to be creative about, you know, approaching it. We have to have dialogue. You know, where there are no points of dialogue, we have to find the common ground. And we have to take responsibility for it. We can't, you know, give this responsibility to others to do. I think that's where we fall down a lot and think that others will do it. I think we have to do it. And we, meaning whoever we are in whatever situation we happen to be in, whether we're a teacher in a school or, you know, an office worker in a corporation or just a member of a physical community, you know, what are we doing to make things better? What are we doing to make things safer? And coming together, people of like mind. And not waiting for a representative to do it or, you know, our surrogates to do it, but for us to do it ourselves, because it transforms us when we're involved in the process. I mean, not only because it's a good thing to do, but it's because it's a transformative, healthy thing to do for us, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I know we've went over the time, but I wanted to mention to our audience that you have a wonderful website, WhitneyYoungFilm.com, where there's, you know, really a lot of great information, particularly the section called Legacy in Action, as well as, you know, the bios for the some of the folks that are, you know, sort of real key to the film, like yourself and the narrator, Afri Woodard. It's like, oh, my goodness. Yeah. It's like, how did you do that?
I know. Well, I really appreciate the time, and I definitely want to encourage people to see it. I always know when people have actually seen the film as opposed to say they've seen the film, because when they see it, they go, oh, my gosh, you know, there's always a reaction. I didn't know that. I learned so much, you know. That's, and I think, and, you know, for me, I learned an awful lot as well doing this. So I think, it's, you know, the reaction has been one of excitement and, you know, discovery, and I want to share that with as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're really happy that, you know, you unwrapped that elephant in your living room for us. Because, I mean, I know, you know, your uncle is really important because I have the stamp and I've got the button from the stamp and I know his name, but I didn't know why he was important. I just knew, like, he was our hero, but, you know, without any details.
Right, exactly. Well, that's exactly why I did, because most people, you know, have the same story, and mm-hmm. And once they see it, then also they understand the relevance of that story to today. So that's mm-hmm. what's really important as well.
Right. Yeah. And then I really, really like the interview with Nanny Jeter. That is just so wonderful. And then Charles Ogletree, who's here, I think at actually no, I guess he's not here, but I mean I've seen him interviewed as an expert a lot, and he's always so succinct and just great about talking about sort of the legal aspects of the day and how that fits in with the tapestry of this African American experience.
Exactly. Well, it's a lot to share with people. You know, it's a legacy for all Americans, I think, and
mm-hmm.
You know, we have to you know, make ourselves, avail ourselves of the stories from many different people and many different cultures, because, you know, we are working this democracy together with others.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, certainly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in your Legacy in Action, you have this list of different programs, because, you know, we're about creating institutions, and so there are a lot of institutions that have your uncle's name connected to them, like the Whitney M. Young Junior Job Corps Center.
Mm-hmm.
And where is that at? Is that in D.C.?
No, that's in Kentucky. It's actually at the same school where he was born. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And then he was the president of the National Association of Social Workers, I guess, from 1969 to 1971. And they still honor, you know, him as a social worker.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've had a lot of, you know, good times going through this process of making a film, and the National Association of Social Workers has been very supportive and really thrilling for me seeing the response of social workers to this film, because, you know, they have really embraced it, you know, him as one of their own, and that's great, because, you know, people who work with the poor a lot of times don't get the kind of respect that they are really due, and admiration that they're due. And I think, you know, it was empowering for them to see how a social worker could have this kind of influence on public policy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Good all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's the Albany Health Center, the Whitney M. Young Junior Health Services. Let's see. Where is that at?
That's in Albany, New York.
Albany, New York. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. And then there's a Whitney M. Young Junior Magnet High School in just
Chicago.
North of the University of Illinois. Is that Chicago?
Yeah, it's in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of the best recognized schools in the country, and definitely in the state of Illinois, school a lot of people want to go to, and we've had fun showing the film to students there as well, to really so that they understand, you know, their namesake and what he accomplished.
Right. And I think it's really cool that at Clark Atlanta University, there's the Whitney M. Young Junior School of Social Work. I think that's really cool.
Exactly, yes. So he was a dean there, and so,
okay.
You know, for them to be able to embrace his name, I think is really excellent as well, yeah.
Yeah. And so last question, hope you have time for it, is I was wondering, you mentioned that an interview that didn't make it into the film, because, you know, you had to make it, you know, 53 minutes. Because with commercials, it makes it an hour. And I was wondering about your uncle's sort of relationship with the Pan-African diaspora, because he was traveling in Africa, or actually he drowned in an accident in Africa in 1971, you know, at 49. We mentioned that he died really young. And so I was wondering if was that something, you know, sort of looking at the scope of our people globally, particularly those that are part of the African diaspora that ended up where we ended up in the Western Hemisphere and in Western culture because of enslavement.
Yeah, well, he, as you mentioned, he had gone to Africa with, you know, American leaders to meet with African leaders because, mm-hmm. you know, he really thought that this was a new day in terms of being able to move forward and work together with Africa. And again, you know, now it's maybe more understood that, you know, this kind of relationship would take place. But at the time, you know, 1971, you know, that wasn't really happening that much. So he was part of a group of people who was moving, you know, into that realm. And I remember reading some letters, you know, that he wrote from Africa and saying that he really was having a great time. He really was enjoying Mother Africa. And, you know, found it really exciting to be there. So I think, you know, a lot of his ideas are global ideas and I think can have value and merit, you know, in the diaspora for African Americans, but also the relationship, the multi-ethnic situations that we find ourselves in all parts of the world right now. You know, this is a global society increasingly. And I think, again, this idea of being able to open up dialogue between groups is really critical, as we see in the world today. The problems occur when people separate themselves. But when they're able to open their lives up and have respect, mutual respect, and recognize the inseparability of all life, this is a crucial point. And so I think that harping back to the way that Young was raised, the idea of respecting oneself and respecting others is kind of the cornerstone of how to make a peaceful world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And the timing of the film couldn't have been more strategic, you know, that the film would be out for the 100th anniversary of the National Urban League, you know, which your uncle was one of its, you know, prominent leaders. So was that, you know, sort of what you were working toward?
No, believe, I mean, you know, I wish I had intentionality. It was just like, okay, where are we going to get the next money so we can do the next shoot? You know, it was just like how things worked out. And yes, we are, you know, about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which he mm-hmm. played a crucial role in as well.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It just kind of has worked out well. Again, it was something that I thought was, I would have finished many years previously now, but it's fine. It's all good. You know, it's all come
yeah.
out
mm-hmm.
really well. So we're happy.
Yeah,
I'm
one talk. You have to go, I know. I just wanted to say, you know, this is really wonderful. And, you know, the serendipity of certain things. I mean, you are certainly, we're being led to do this and your whole team. And it's a really wonderful, wonderful film. And we're looking forward to seeing you in August because you're going to be coming here, right?
Yes, I will be coming again. And my son lives in the Bay Area, so I always have great motivation to come up. He's actually involved in a couple of the screenings that are going to be happening in the Bay Area mm-hmm. This month. So, but we now visit the Bay Area a lot more than I have before. So.
Right. Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much. We're going to, you don't have to stay on for this, but I'm going to play a clip, the trailer. So thank you so much for this extended conversation about the film that's going to be airing on ITVS or PBS on February 18th. People should check the listings for the times.
Perfect. Thank
Bye.
You.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You don't get black power by chance. You get it by doing what the other groups have done. The Irish kept quiet. They didn't shout Irish power or Jew power or Italian power. They kept their mouths shut and took over the police department of New York City and the mayorship of Boston.
Whitney Young's genius was. He knew how to accomplish what other people were merely for.
I think that Whitney Young was a prophet. I think that he died precisely at a time when few people understood how brilliant his vision for racial transformation of American power was.
He was a figure who was calm, who was purposeful, who was measured.
Whitney Young, he's the Wall Street of the civil rights movement.
Whitney understood power, and he understood politics. And most of all, he understood people. They said Martin was in the streets and Roy and Thurgood were in the courts and Whitney was in the boardroom. One could not have been successful without the other.
That was the trailer for the Power Broker, Whitney Young's fight for civil rights. And we're really happy to speak to the executive producer, Mr. Young's niece, Bonnie Boswell, about this great film that's going to be airing this month, Black History Month, 2013, February 18th. And want remember Bob Marley, Nesta Robert Marley, who was born today, February 6, 1945, in Nine Miles, Jamaica. And he made his transition May 11th, 1981. Another friend was also born today, Jamal Ali, and he made his transition in 2011, and after a fight about with cancer. And he was a wonderful poet, and he's a writer, and his Heartfire Rendezvous is still available. It's a great, great love story that's magical realism. So I want to send a shout out to my good friend Jamal Ali and Bob Marley, who is a wonderful, wonderful artist and real visionary, definitely a visionary. And we're going to close the show with a wonderful piece by Billy Harper called Knowledge of Self.
Fletcher's grandness, the heir to his big bandness, was a master arrived to forever lay out the blue wonderfulness of the orchestra, Duke Ellington, whose greatness transcends all trends. Duke told Max, don't let them call your music jazz, because they can make anything that. What prophecy, cold and true. Why, they can say what your boy, what's-his-name, Elevated G is playing, is that. You dig? But then, what's-his-name was the king of jazz, and what's the other dude was the king of swing? And we now up to in that alley, banging on them tin pans, they call it swing. But they meant a noun, not a verb. Never could get the verb in it. Remember all them ladies and men, masters and mistresses of the verbal thing? Ethel Waters in her blue, new American classical popular song, and Billy, who reached the deepest tear in our heart, and Ella, all flying off them wonderful bands who carried our hearts, our meaning in their songs. The royalty like Duke and the Count of Basie, the lady who made her alliance with the real American president, Mr. Young, and you know they swung. Bean, the Mighty Hawk, taught us all how Lewis sounded on another horn, and the cats in their band, Duke's people at the top of the steeple, Johnny Hodges, Harry Carney, Cootie Williams, Cat Anderson, Paul Gonzales, Ben Webster, and other greats who morphed into another age. If the 20s was the jazz age, then the 30s, the Great Depression, people seemed like they got skinny. But the age of swing, from all those songs, the world was looking for love, but it seemed like there wasn't any. Goose-stepping in Europe, Pain in Spain, they was painting mustaches on the Mona Lisa and putting a commode in the museum. Had civilization stopped? My man Helene said they couldn't stop bebop, and they won't stop hip-hop. Bird Blue, Dizzy New, Max carried our original earth to this place where we grew. Bud smiled and here come miles. There was a B and a bop. It's just another beat, another B and another app. Where the is and the un-is cohabit the same frame. But the sound was a verb, not a noun, unless you couldn't Congo style really get down our share shake. But then the could did, and then them original hipsters appeared with the Vance and the Bowie O'Rooney. Said you gotta have them black notes, actually they is blue. I want my fist flattened. And you gotta have the drum where we and the music come from. Dig, that word was the first I heard. It all came beyond paper. For the proper syncopation, you gotta have improvisation. We're gonna take them tired chords and make our own songs, our own stories. Otherwise, it's too dull. It don't swing. It ain't hip. We said we wanted wild, crazy, frantic. We wanted it to be exactly like us. Gone from the square world or out to lunch. My man Symphony Sid from the jazz corner of the world. It sounded like there was never anything before as hip as Birdland and this lullaby where I first heard the divine one. Sassy say, you're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy. You're not that kind of a boy for a girl like me. What? And we heard of Fats Navarro and Fat Girl and Kenny Clark and Coog and Long Tall Dexter Gordon and Stan Getz and Zoot Sims. We heard the hippest people in the world. But remember, when you go out, somebody's gonna try to bring you back in. Bop was too hot, the Annie Bop squad say. Too fast, too crazy. Crazy, we said. The counterattack was to bring it back. You all been out to lunch too long, whether it was swing or bebop, Disney dream. If you wanted a cop, you had to hit the street. No road out of the jungle, that's 52nd Street, where the Charleston hit the New York docks. 12th Avenue was a shock. From Angola to the gullahs in South Carolina, got the first thing smoke, went up to New York. Charleston, James P. wrote. Greet those who landed in the devil's northern house. Hell's Kitchen, to be exact. San Juan Hill, Monk and Vinnie Carter's home, where Lincoln Center sits still. That's right. He on the only money that ain't white. But what we was trying to say, when it got too hot, some folks tipped away from that street. I think it was the heat. Last seen heading west, they next address. It was cool, really cool. Some said, calm down. Miles said, get down. Stan heard, Clue, Budo, Jerry heard, Lee heard, John Lewis heard, Gil Evans heard, Poncho Haygood heard. They gave birth to the school, the real birth of the cool. And the memory of the hip started to slip. The gorgeous blue, the funk we knew. They're gonna bend their knees and raise it back from the mood indigo that flows out of the black. What was bad could be bad. Much, much better than that. Let's spoke that. So when cool started to fool with my man JoJo's soul, he went out and put the church in. Where the Negro's eyes be rolling back in their head and start speaking some stuff ain't never been said. A dude named Buhana played them drums like he was insane. I'm from the blue continent of dark under your heartbeat. Dudes named Horace drug the funky gospel into the joints, hollering, "Let me see what you do with your shovel." And the Holy Ghost popping his tambourine, chick-a-ching, rattle in the room. That's nasty to bring Africa and the Lord in like that. He wanted a messenger from the Holy Ghost Mau Mau Baptist Church, and they got a message from Kenyon 125th Street, the University of Blakey, the Academy of, well, it might have seemed like that, but it really was this. Well, you could dig Hank Mobley and listen nobly to the man who called the uncrowned king, Kenny Dorham, but always so many others came to fill up the space with names of that school, Clifford Brown, Luke Donaldson, Chrissy Heath, Donald Byrd, Jack McLean, Lee Morgan, Benny Golson, all the way to Billy Harper and Wynton Marsalis. With all that love for the saving of the deep historical fonts, the blues, the ancient call and response from across the trees and through the woods, so you know where I am and I wait for your response. Our blue life memory all the way back across the world. The zigzag of chance, the improv, and fix however to the mighty drum, the rhythm of life. What has no beat cannot stay. What was called hard bop was something to wake us up again to the rhythm of ourselves. Max and Brownie, along with Buhana, helped bring the fire back. The post-cool smoke fanned through the wings of the great bird, but now the heavy motion would be by train. We call that band of Miles the Hydrogen Bomb and Switchblade Band. Paul and Red, Cannonball, the Funkus, Mad Philly Joe and Train, the monster with the horn. Actually, Miles' great band was but a preface to another awesome being, Train's Coy Tyner, Jimmy Garrison, Elvin Jones. But Train had to pass through the sphere of Thelonious to get deep into the mysterioso of the funk, leaving the world of the merely hip for the monkishly profound. Monk and Train at the Five Spot opened the new world of Other Than Where You've Been. Let me tell you, I was there. Train didn't even know the arrangements. He sounded like a stranger. But in a minute, Train was in it, and the whole building moved and pulled away. Little Rudy Tootie jackying in Monk's moves. So around midnight, the new music came. We never was the same. By the time they got from the Bowery to Carnegie Hall, must have been time for something next stop new. Even a Pharaoh, an Ornette, an Albert, a Sun Ra fell by. They heard Train's cry. Monk's blew inside. A new world welcomed those with ears to hear.
That was Billy Harper's. And the voice you heard was, of course, Mary Baraka. And I want to make a couple of announcements. Want to let folks know there's a whole lot of great, great writers coming through the Marcus Bookstore, and I have some more details on Friday's show. But I want to let folks know about the Mbutu Award, Shared Humanity, and those awards given by Priority Africa Network are going to be happening on Saturday, February 16th at the Terrace Room at the Lake Merritt Hotel. That's 1800 Madison Street in Oakland, California. And the program, it's the 10th anniversary of Priority Africa Network and the 3rd anniversary of the Mbutu Awards dinner and ceremony. It's always just really fun. And it's from 5:30 to 8:30. The keynote is going to be Dr. Amina Mama, Nigerian author and professor and human rights advocate. And the music is going to be by Fali Shachau from Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire. And the MC is Oakland's Gregory Hodge, Minister Hodge. And the honorees this year are Malanga Kaskalur Center for the Arts, Emmanuel Nadeau, KALW Radio and Echoes of Africa, Eritrean Youth for Change, and Dr. Siri Brown at Merritt College. For information, you can visit priorityafrica.org. And you can call 510-652-1493. And you can also email info at priorityafrica.org. And Mbutu is a word that means the essence of being human. So that's in a couple of weeks. And this weekend, Raw Talent presents Tease Harmony, a spoken word theater piece by Richmond Youth, and that's Saturday, February 9th from 6 to 9 p.m. at El Cerrito High School Theater, 540 Ashby Avenue in El Cerrito. And the keynote speaker is going to be Luis J. Rodriguez, the author, poet, humanitarian, who is known for his book, Always Running, La Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. And you can buy tickets at teesharmony.eventbrite.com. Let's see, anything else? You can get tickets at the door, and there are no phone numbers. So anyway, that's that information. And the last thing I want to share with you is information about a second annual Voices of Healing concert, February 24th at 4 p.m. It's a free concert, but people can make donations. And it's going to be at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church, 2420 Ashby Avenue in Berkeley. And Reverend Leslie R. White is the senior pastor. And this sounds really, really wonderful. The groups that are going to be featured are the East Bay Joint Mass Choir. Terry Simmons is the director. She's the person that told me about this, too. The Oakland Youth Chorus. Linnell Martin is the artistic director. The UC Berkeley Gospel Choir with Dr. Mark Wilson, PhD, is the director. The Berkeley High School Jazz Band, Sarah Klein is the director. And the Oakland East Bay, the Oakland Bay Area Community Choir, and Professor William Bell is the director. And so it's going to be phenomenal. And so definitely you want to try to get to this free concert, the second annual Voice of Healing concert. It sounds just fantastic. And again, that's February 24th at St. Paul AME Church in Berkeley, 2420 Ashby Avenue. So that's going to really be phenomenal. All righty. So looking forward to another edition of Wanda's Picks on Friday, February 8th. Until then, have a peaceful and wonderful Wednesday and a peaceful and wonderful day where, you know, Bob Marley was born today and Jamal Ali was born today, two wonderful spirits. And we had a great interview with Ms. Boswell about her uncle, Whitney Young. Peace and blessings.